were not and have not been covered by any statute.
Was there an attempt at, during those either two previous efforts, to put the non-certificated employees into the language or into the bill, or do you know?
I don't recall the legislative history of that time.
And did the, when did the Kozlowski Amendment come in? Right along with the para bill, it was?
On the floor.
Okay, thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Manis. Mr. Burgess? We're on teleconference. Would you state your name for the record, please?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Scott Burgess with the Alaska Municipal League. I wasn't sure I was going to testify. It was teleconference, and my understanding is that it's going to subcommittee, and I was going to hold my comments. However, there's been some discussion outside the bill, or at least the bills before you, in terms of adding some amendments that would change the judiciary version, so I think I needed to speak up, at least to get those comments on the record. We would oppose both the Hess version and oppose any change in the judiciary version to not allow the opt-out. We're not enthralled with the judiciary version, but I do want to indicate that we are opposed. You should have our position papers to HB 170 as it was originally introduced in the Hess version in your packet. As far as, and that's based on the mandatory requirement that municipalities or political subdivisions be mandated into para or any provisions to require binding arbitration through requirements on local ordinances. I'm not here opposed to collective bargaining. As far as the judiciary version, I think it was unfortunate that hearing was somewhat confused, to say the least, but I would like to let the committee know that there were clarifications in that hearing that the intent of the committee was not to change provisions of the Kowalski Amendment, nor to deal with binding arbitration. And I think that the problem that you have before you is just understanding what, in fact, that piece of legislation does. And it's very difficult when you have this so-called Kowalski Amendment or Section 4, Chapter 113, SLA 172, outside the statute in terms of what that reference means. But basically does provide for the opt-out. And there was clarification by myself, among others, that in fact, what the committee was passing did not affect that, as was proposed in the Hess version, where it said actually repeal that section, nor were there any attempt to require binding arbitration in passing that version. And so we did not mount any great opposition to that version at that time. I must say that since that time, there has been some confusion. I would assume that in your packets you do have some language was provided by legal services in terms of the interpretation of what, in fact, the judiciary version does. But we would oppose any requirement that would not allow the continuation of the ability for municipalities, school districts, to opt out under para or any attempt to require, if local ordinances were adopted, that they would have to have as a final action binding arbitration the right to strike. Happy to answer any questions.
Representative Gull.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Burgess, I guess I certainly am understanding that the section of 170 as written by the Labor and Commerce Committee that is of greatest concern to you is the applicability issue as opposed to the rights of the non-certificated school employees. Just a quick clarification on the opt-out provision in statute today. Is it, are there any restrictions on your, not your, but on a municipality, or if you can, on a school district's, how shall I say it, options in dealing with their employees that are required for you to opt out? In other words, can you just opt out by a vote, or do you have to do anything or fit or suit or meet any standards in terms of labor relations in order to opt out under current
Mr. Chairman,
law?
Representative Gall, the reason I wasn't jumping forward is because the way the bill is, it does now deal with non-certificated education employees, but the ultimate issue, of course, is dollars, and the municipalities need to have control over that issue in terms of the final dollar figure. That's why we're here. For to answer your question specifically, the municipality or school district would have to pass an ordinance or resolution is what the language says in the actual amendment or Section 4, which is what we're referring to here. There is some question in terms of timeline of when that can be done. It's not intended to be something that can prevent collective bargaining. So it needs to be done by the municipality, not as a means to void all that process, but something that they choose to do in and of themselves.
Yes, sir, I understand that, and I appreciate your explanation. I just want to establish for my mind and for the record that what has been told to me, which is that, and I'm using the language in the original bill, which is carried over in the Hess bill, I believe, which references political subdivisions as a whole, and not school districts in particular. It indicates that it alters the opt-out provision. My question to you is just pretty straightforward. The opt-out provision is simply a provision which allows a municipality or a school district to opt out of para, period, and it doesn't have any caveats on it that require you to do something as a prerequisite. Is that correct?
Except to pass, Mr. Chairman, except to pass an ordinance,
right.
A resolution.
Right.
I think it has not been, this Kowalski Amendment or Section 4 has not been as much an issue for school districts because the way the law is currently, it's clear what they have to do with teachers under Title 14, and it's clear under PARA that non-certificated employees are not covered. So the Kowalski Amendment or Section 4, Chapter 113, has been mostly talked about in terms of municipalities covering their employees.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, sir. Going on to Kodiak, Mr. Bruce Garrett, please.
Yes, sir. Thank you. I would like to make an observation as a comment to me as I've been listening to the testimony this afternoon. When you gentlemen pass the legislation that gives certified folks the right to vote, you'll also be speaking to another very important issue. I recently had opportunity to visit with some people from another school district, and they're not, we had an organization for quite a while. Our employees are pretty well informed, but they had no organization, and I listened to one of the members of their administration or school board speak to a very rosy picture in their school district, and I know that this one individual is being paid for a three-hour job and told they have to work till you get it done. It takes them 5 hours, many days. They don't believe they have any rights. They're afraid to step forward and exert their rights. And I believe in passing this legislation that you'll be speaking to a large group of employees and telling them, yes, that you do have rights, and the state recognizes that you do have rights. And I think that that's a statement that's very important to be made. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Garrett. In Kodiak, is there any sites that have anybody that would like to testify before we close this teleconference down? Is there anybody in the public here in Juneau that would like to testify? Sir, Carl. Before we go on to you, Mr. Rose, is there any sites after Mr. Rose gives his testimony that would like to testify before we send this bill into subcommittee? Hearing none, go ahead, Mr. Rose.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Carl Rose, I'm with the Association of Alaska School Boards. I have a couple of questions that I need to get some clarification on in terms of the committee substitute for House Bill 170. What does this bill, in fact, do? If, in fact, we do remove the non-certificated employees from their current status, does this, in fact, give them the right to strike or seek binding arbitration? I think failure to answer this question, for me and for my association and our members, we have to deal with effective management and the delivery of education at the local level. In terms of the right to strike, in terms of the right to strike and buy an arbitration, in the case of buy an arbitration, that removes that decision to a third party. As you all are aware, we're not autonomous, and we can't deal with those additional expenses that can be incurred. My concern is that failure to have an opt-out clause, as referred to as a Kozlowski Amendment, makes an unmanageable situation for local school districts. More importantly than that, I have just reviewed, and I'm sorry I'm not better prepared, but I have just reviewed clarification for, to Representative John Sun from Legislative Counsel Teresa Kramer, which in fact makes an exception in the case of Sitka and does not make that same exception in the case of Petersburg when they applied for an opt-out position relating to time. There is no time provided in the Kozlowski Amendment, and I would like some clarification as to what would be a timely fashion by which a political subdivision or legislative body would have to exercise this opt-out provision. I think failure to do so in a timely fashion and failure to be allowed to opt out, the end result would be unmanageable for a local school district, but more importantly, what does that do in terms of the right to strike and binding arbitration?
Representative Boyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think that on the question of timeline, that's fairly well established under court cases regarding DePERA. And the as I've read those things, it's been a couple of years since I've looked at them, but when I last looked at them, there's a kind of an unlimited timeline under which a municipal government under PERA can opt out. However, as was discussed, I mean, you couldn't just jump into the process of adopting a local ordinance after it looked as if a local employee group had begun the process of organization and that type of thing. I mean, that's where you get into problems, as if you're retaliating by adopting a local ordinance against the organization efforts of a group of employees. That's clearly a place that the timeline comes into effect. But absent that kind of thing, that kind of action, and the court cases are, again, where that's established, there isn't, it's an open-ended thing. So a school district would have an unlimited amount of time under which to opt out. And that, I think, has been left there purposefully open and vague so that you can have the working take place in the local community, so that you can have those forces that want to see that take place have their opportunity to muster their forces. And, of course, the anti-forces or the people who are against that or that effort to also muster their support and fight it out at the school board level or, in the case of municipal governments, at the city council or borough assembly level.
Representative Pointer. Mr. Chairman,
yes.
I would just state that if a timely fashion is not a factor, my main concern is that under the opt-out provision, if any of our member school districts should fail to satisfy that provision and we're not allowed to opt out, it could be a very unmanageable situation and detrimental to the delivery of education at the local level.
Thank you, sir. Representative Boyer.
I just think it's important to say, too, as a matter of public record, that I'm not necessarily opposed to the opt-out provision, because I do think it provides for the work to be done at the local level. I think that there ought to be finality in that opportunity, though, and it's not under the current law under PERA anyway. It's not a reversible decision. That once you've opted under the provisions of PERA, you're under the provisions of PERA. Now, of course, there are others around that if there is a bill that's been introduced to reverse that process. But what you don't want to have happen is employees to be jerked around under one system and then under another system and have to deal or kind of be perhaps victimized by the vagaries of a political climate in a community. And that's why we've got PERA, and that's why I think some people wanted to see certificated, non-certificated employees under PERA because of that certainty that it brings. But I'm not particularly opposed. I've been thinking about this a lot to allowing that opt-out. So I'm just letting everybody know that I'm not predisposed on this issue.
Representative Gull.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just quickly, I'm also learning about this opt-out provision, I must admit, for the first time. I'm somewhat familiar with the other issue. And so while you're at the table, Mr. Rose, I'd like to pose a question, and I'm not sure if you'll care to answer it or Mr. Manners or Mr. McPeters, but it's something that's referenced in the school administrator's testimony, which comments, I guess to preface my question, it seems to me that if the teachers are covered under one chapter or one title, and the non-certificated employees would be included under PERA, and that brings in the opt-out discussion, which applies to PERA specifically. I can understand that there's some confusion about what the impact of this will be insofar as I guess the basic underlying premise is providing some ability for non-certificated employees to discuss their terms of employment. So what I'd appreciate is if I could get some clarification either from you or from Mr. McPheeters or Mr. Manners as to what would happen if this issue were addressing inclusion of non-certificated employees under the labor sections of Title 14, and if the entire issue would then be very different. And I think before the subcommittee begins its work, it might be useful to have some comments from the three of you in that regard as to what that means to the questions before us.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, I'd like to defer to Mr. McPheeters, as that's his communique, to establish that position.
Thank you, sir.
Very well.
Thank you.
Yes. State your name for the record, please.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'm Steve McPeters. I'm with the Alaska Council of School Administrators, and you have our position paper. And referring to your question, Representative Dahl, what one of our concerns was, as stated in the paper, is that we now have, working under, in the educational family, education world, working under the chapter or Title 14 of the state statutes. And in Title 14 does specifically state that a school district shall negotiate in good faith with certificated personnel. And that means teachers as well as principals whom other organizations have organized in them. It does not, or it deletes, the non-certificated personnel. If, indeed, this bill went through as it is stated, the judiciary version, then we have a school district having to bring themselves up to par with what para means, and we're dealing with two separate state statutes, which then, again, is going to be a tremendous confusion, and if you want to say increase the legal costs for making sure that all the provisions are met under para versus all the provisions are met under the Alaska Statute Title 14. It seems that if we're going to deal with school employees, then let's deal with school employees under the respective title, and that would be Chapter 14, Title 14.
Further questions, Representative Call?
Mr. McPheeters, would you do I understand you correctly to assert that it's your understanding, and I'm looking for the exact section here, so I apologize, I can't read it to you, but is it your understanding that inclusion of some sort of language under Title 14 would require that the school district collectively bargain with non-certificated employees without creating the para issue that you and Mr. Rose raised?
It is my understanding that's correct, because in the in Chapter 14 or Title 14, it does lay out what the requirements are of negotiating with the certificated personnel, and also it lays out some of the ground rules in the bargaining and what happens down the step, the chain of command as to the decisions and coming to conclusions and so forth.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Boyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I had seen that also, and I was curious whether or not this effort's been around in different incarnations for years, and I'm curious whether or not you could support it if it were under Title 14.
At this point, I would like to work with the subcommittee on that issue before I make any statements.
It's been around under that title before, has it not? And
no.
It has not?
Okay. Not to my knowledge. Not to my knowledge.
Yeah. I wasn't sure. That's why I thought I'd ask. But I
represent Frank.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I thought a couple of years ago when we had the mining arbitration issue before us that I assume that was Title 14, but that it was involved in that bill 2 years ago, or whenever it was, maybe it was 3 years ago.
For the non-certificated personnel?
Yeah, yeah. To recognize them and allow them to negotiate. Now, if we, am I clear that if you put it under Title 14, there would be no right to strike or binding arbitration? If you go under para, they would have the right, some limited right to strike, is that correct?
That's my understanding of the statute.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Representative Gull?
Just a comment for clarification, if I may, to Representative Frank. This has been said about four times today in the hearing, and I just think it's worthwhile to maybe establish, unless there's somebody on the committee who disagrees, that every employee who's not covered by a collective bargaining act under statute has the right to strike, and no employee who's not covered under a collective bargaining act of some sort has a right to binding arbitration. Yeah, we can strike if we want. It's just that the public might not appreciate it.
Boy, you confuse me now.
Thank you very much. Representative Boyer, before I send this into subcommittee consisting of Representative Boyer, Chair, Representative Gull, and Representative Frank, is there a timeline for a schedule for this particular bill?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, thanks. I'd like to have a subcommittee meeting early next week. I'm unfortunately going to be in Fairbanks over the weekend, but early next week we'll try to schedule something up that's convenient for subcommittee members and other members here that are interested in working with us, hopefully to get something back before the full committee by the end of next week.
Thank you very much. That concludes our agenda for today. House Finance is adjourned.
Peter.
Who does?
Al's going to be pleased.
I really do know that.
Would the House Finance please come to order? The first bill I'm going to take up is by Representative Dave Donnelly. We have before us Committee Substitute for House Joint Resolution Number 8, Judiciary. This bill is the result of the finding by Justice Burke of the Alaska Supreme Court, who found that the wording of the Alaska local hire laws conflict with certain language in the Alaska Constitution. This bill clarifies the right of state government to give reasonable preference to residents of the state and makes the wording of the Alaska Constitution consistent with the U.S. Constitution. If passed, this issue would be on the measure on the ballot in the next general election. The bill is accompanied by a fiscal note of $2,200 from the Division of Elections. Representative Donnelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think your introductory remarks pretty much spell it out. It's very simple. Simply a little problem. The Alaska Constitution has a more stringent equal protection clause than the federal Constitution. And it would be a shame if our new local hire law met constitutional muster under the federal Constitution but did not meet the test of the Alaska Equal Protection Clause. So the proposal is to simply add one sentence to the Constitution, a new section that says nothing in the state Constitution would, and what this really says is nothing in the state Constitution shall be interpreted as being stronger than the federal Constitution in this area.
Is there any question of the sponsor? Yes. I do have Mr. Ron Lawrenson from Department of Law. If there's a question with the law part. Representative Brown.
Which section of the Constitution is it, of the state Constitution, that's a problem?
It's the state equal protection clause that was identified in the concurring opinion in the Francis case.
Article 1, and Section 1.
What does that provide, and specifically, what is the problem?
Well, Mr. Chairman,
yes,
basically the... the Alaska Equal Protection Clause is much more in detail, has much more detailed verbiage, and we could get you copies of both, than the Federal Equal Protection Clause. Usually, the Federal Equal Protection Clause is not the main sticking point when it comes to local employment preference laws. It's the Federal Privileges and Immunities Clause. The tests we need to meet for the Federal Equal Protection Clause are somewhat less than the Privileges and Immunities Clause. But since the Alaska Equal Protection Clause is written so much more specifically and so much stronger than the federal clause, the concurring opinion of the Alaska Supreme Court in the Francis case pointed this out for the first time. And in fact, this was picked up in the Alaska Law Review this in the summer, this very recent article. There's a whole article discussing this unique situation here in Alaska. So the issue here is, if we meet all the federal tests, do we want to lose on a state constitutional test? And the proposal simply would clarify that our Constitution shouldn't be interpreted as being stronger than the federal Constitution providing those protections.
So the troublesome portion is that the language, is this it, Section 1, inherent rights in the original bill? Is that it?
Yes.
That all persons are equal and entitled to equal rights, and so if we try to have local hire laws that discriminate in favor of Alaskans, we run afoul of this constitutional provision. Would that be an accurate statement?
Through the chair. Yes, it's written in, it goes into much more detail than the Federal Equal Protection Clause.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Gull?
Thank you, sir. Representative Donnelly, I've got two questions. First of all, can you give me the phrase in the U.S. Constitution that would limit the rights of Alaska to grant preferences? I mean, when you say consistent with the Constitution of the United States, what does that mean? What sort of preferences could we grant under the Constitution of the United States?
Well, Representative, through the chair, Representative Gall, that's a very complicated question you've just asked. Basically, there are three major portions of the federal Constitution that put restrictions upon the states when you deal with local preference laws. The first is the Commerce Clause, but that's been pretty much ruled as it's a really complicated question. You have three major clauses of the federal Constitution, Equal Protections Clause, the Privileges and Immunities Clause, and the Commerce Clause that usually come into play when you're dealing with a local hire law by a state government. They don't necessarily apply to action by the federal government, but they do apply to state government action. The Commerce Clause is pretty much off to one side at this point in time because there's been some recent cases, and I think it was the Camden case that said the Commerce Clause doesn't present a problem if the laws are done in a certain manner. The Equal Protection Clause, again, we think we've met most of those criteria successfully in other states. Because there's a different level of scrutiny regarding the Equal Protection Clause than there is with the Privileges and Immunities Clause. When you get to the Privileges and Immunities Clause, then you've got a real tough one to deal with. And that's the one that the courts usually use to strike down state-drafted local higher preference laws.
Representative, I'll, then maybe I should ask the gentleman after you're done from the Department of Law to comment on that specific section, just so I'll understand it. Do you feel that the, just so I can get the legislative history, the change from the original bill to the judiciary version, which I guess is the last version before us, right? Was that intended to address the impression that in the original bill it spoke to preferences and it didn't speak to employment preferences, so that it just was too broad in the view of the Judiciary Committee and they tightened it up here? Is that what was happening?
Through the chair, the main issue to the Judiciary Committee was that there may be other parts of the Alaska Constitution that could be interpreted as potentially prohibiting a preference to Alaskan citizens also. And the committee thought that by creating a separate section of the Constitution that explained this, that it would apply to all the Alaska Constitution and not to just one section or article in the Constitution, and that it was a good idea to expand to the entire Constitution.
I guess I tend to support that version, too, because it states employment preferences to residents rather than granting preferences, period, which seemed a little broad. Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Further questions? Yes, Representative Larson?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I just wanted to help Representative Donnelly some with his answer to Representative Gall here, if I may take this one second to read. You know, what must the state do? It says, first, the state must prove that a substantial reason exists for the discrimination. To fulfill this requirement, the state must show that non-residents constitute a particular source of evil that the discrimination is designed to combat. And second, the state must narrowly tailor a statute so that, in the opinion of the court, a reasonable relationship exists between the dangers represented by non-citizens as a class in a severe discrimination practice upon them. In other words, as I take it, and maybe with his experience, Representative Donnelly can help me understand this question too, is that there must be a substantial reason, and it can be increased social, antisocial behavior and so forth. And if the state can prove that as a cause because local employment is being taken by non-residents, then the courts have basically said that we have met the standards that local hire laws can be upheld under. Is that basically it?
That pretty much basically is it, plus one other condition that the solution is narrowly tailored to address that problem.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. No further questions. Thank you, Mr. Bushwell. Yes. Representative Rieger?
Yes. Just to go through again, an employment preference to residents of the state means all residents, not a subset of residents. Is that the upshot of that? Okay. I had one other question, Mr. Chairman. The on the ballot question, is there going to be a question that explains this as part of the ballot as well? And if so, is that something that you would have elected not to phrase as a question, rather leave up to the administration to phrase the question to put on the election pamphlet?
Through the chair?
Yes.
My understanding is that, and I'm not certain whether it's divisional elections, but I know there's some part of state government that's their duty to prepare a short explanation of all constitutional amendments and initiatives that are brought before the voters to give like a pro and con side to them or explain to what it does and be in the voter's guide.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, sir.
Mr. Chairman, could I just ask Representative Rieger through the chair while Mr. Donnelly is here? I noticed that, too, and I just was wondering whether there had been discussion of that issue of dividing state residents under this language. I assume that the intent of the amendment would say this Constitution does not prohibit the state from granting employment preferences applying equally to all residents of the state. That's what you intend by this language, right? I added in my reading, after preferences, the phrase applying equally, and after the word to, the word all, so that it reads preferences applying equally to all residents of the state. I mean, this suggests to me that although there may be other grounds in the Constitution why it's illegal, that under this language, a person could say that all carpenters who are have experience would be given preference, rather than all Alaskans would be given preference, all Alaskan carpenters, so to speak. Maybe that was discussed in another committee.
Mr. Chairman, one of the things we found in our research on local hire laws is that the interpretation by the federal courts of the federal constitution may in some cases allow us to give a preference for a certain area of our state where we wouldn't be able to do that for the entire state. In other words, if you found there was a particularly unique situation, and the present situation right now is in the northwest part of Alaska, the local hire law is in effect there now. And in the Camden case, this 1983 case, the United States Supreme Court, I think it was a 1983 case, they pointed out that there may be some rationality to local governments being allowed to do this where just not a whole state. And if you go back to a constitutional a scholar's point of view, a philosophical point of view, this makes sense because the federal constitution, one of the reasons they allow the federal government to do more local hire than the states is because the states are more parochial, and they're liable to, we as only serving the electorate of our state are more likely to discriminate against citizens of other states. Whereas if it's the federal government doing it, they have a larger picture, so it'd be more appropriate for if the federal government wanted to say that in Alaska, Alaskans have a preference on these jobs, they might be able to get away with that constitutionally. But the state can't do that without jumping through these other hoops. And the Privileges and Immunities Clause very specifically says no state shall make a law. It's really geared to the state governments. But when you start to break it down within subdivisions within a state, you have less of a philosophical problem because you can see they're not just granting a preference to anybody in that state just because they happen to be citizens. They're trying to address a more narrowly tailored specific problem like we have in the northwest area of the state right now.
So then I guess by adding that language, that would, in a sense, limit the ability of the state to deal with local hire, so to speak.
Exactly.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Frank?
Yeah, on that, that bill we passed a few years ago for local hire doesn't treat all members, all residents of the state equally at all. I mean, it does provide for specific classes of people based upon either geographical unemployment rates or minorities. I don't know if we had a deal in there for women, but I know we had one for minority. So it clearly isn't, doesn't treat all people equally. If we did put language as Representative Gall suggests in there, I think we'd find that our own local hire law would be inconsistent with the Constitution. Ironically.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Mr. Lawrenson? Would you state your name for the record, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Ron Lawrenson. I'm Deputy Attorney General in the Department of Law. I'm more than happy to answer any questions you've got. I'd like to offer one observation, though, with respect to the CS. This CS, and I did not attend the earlier committee meeting, so I don't know all the discussion, and it may be that I could have raised this concern earlier had I known that it was going to be addressed. This committee CS focuses in on those situations where an employment preference is involved. There are other situations. In other words, it says don't apply a different standard than the U.S. Constitution would apply in situations where there is an employment preference granted by Alaska. But the state does grant a variety of other preferences to residents. It grants a bidder's preference, for instance, for contractors who want to bid on state jobs, which would not be covered by the language of this, what I'll call an exemption, from a different rule being applied. So I'd be a little bit concerned that by now singling out one kind of preference, would be indicating, I think some members of a court at least, would certainly interpret that as meaning that it's okay to apply a more stringent Alaska standard to any other preference but employment. by singling out one area and saying, don't apply a more stringent standard in that area. The converse of that is to suggest that it's okay and intended that a more stringent standard would apply to any other area. And I'm not sure that that really is, from a lawyer's point of view, trying to defend these various preferences. And other preferences are things that would fall into the category of preferences would be, some people might argue that entitlement to a permanent fund dividend is a preference. It only goes to residents. Entitlement to longevity bonus is a preference for residents because it only goes to residents. So all of those things people could try to argue constitute preferences which are not covered by this exclusion and therefore should be analyzed under a more stringent Alaska Equal Protection Standard. And I'd hate to have to face that argument unless that's really here in the legislature what the purpose is to only identify employment preferences as being subject to a less stringent federal standard. So I throw that out for as a concern that I'd like to have you think about at least.
Representative Gull.
Thank you, sir. Have there been litigation filed in the past challenging, I know that there have with loan programs, and I know that we've balanced our statutes to try to accommodate that, not to have 10-year residence preferences on, you know, student loans and so on, but 2 years was found to be a balance. Have there been suits filed on longevity bonus permanent fund?
Not on that basis, not yet, no.
But you might expect one someday.
It's certainly possible
and
as long as
happen when
the argument filed. The argument sits there if someone wants to challenge it. What will happen?
Well, I mean, I'm sorry, I shouldn't have interrupted you, and that's not really a good question. What would you project would be the outcome of such a suit like that?
It's going to depend on the nature of the benefit that's being provided.
Oh, permanent fund.
Permanent fund. I think a court would say that it's permissible for the state to only give permanent fund dividends to
longevity
its own residents.
Longevity bonus.
Same thing.
Resident preference based on, in hiring, based on documented needs, such as what we've had to go through before. You think that can sustain a challenge?
That's a far more difficult area, and that's what we're facing right now. I think, and I testified to this, and I think it's Dave's view, too, because Dave spent a lot of time, Representative Donnelly spent a lot of time in this area as well. I think we have a much better chance of getting the present local hire law upheld in a federal court than we do in our own state courts, in part because of this concern about a different equal protection standard being applied under the Alaska Constitution.
So it's your opinion that, well, what about a state suit on longevity bonus with a 6-month residency? Why would our state courts be amenable to supporting that in your view?
Because, well, there are two different issues there. One is, do you give it to residents only? And the other is, how long do you have to be here before you're considered a resident for purposes of getting the benefit? I think the courts will say, yes, it's certainly reasonable for the state of Alaska to say that only residents of Alaska will receive a benefit from the earnings of the permanent fund.
Longevity bonus. I guess.
Okay, longevity bonus. Same argument would apply. And I think they would say the same thing, that we don't have an obligation to provide longevity bonus payments of support to elderly residents of the state of Washington or the state of New Jersey or the state of Florida.
But, you know, certainly general fund is general fund. And
but it's Alaska's general fund, and I think to that
right,
extent.
Right, and why not apply that to public construction?
Well, in the public construction area, that might turn out to be the rule because we're talking about an equal protection analysis. The problem comes up in the privileges and immunities area.
That was what Representative Donnelly left off on. Can
right.
you be specific about that?
The privileges and immunities clause is a provision in the federal constitution, which does not appear in our own constitution. There's no analog to it in the Alaska Constitution. And the privileges and immunities provision of the U.S. Constitution has been the constitutional provision over the last, well, since 1978, over those years that the courts have relied on in invalidating employment preferences for residents in various states across the country, not just Alaska.
Saying that all American citizens are entitled to the same privileges,
the right,
and immunities.
Same privileges and immunities, and that in all of those cases, the states involved, and it's not just Alaska, it's been a number of other states as well, had not shown a valid independent basis need for providing a preference to their residents which would override the constitutional requirement.
Okay, my last question is just if you went back to the original bill, whose language I assume you prefer, what would you do to strengthen that language, if anything, to ensure equal protection under the law among state residents? Do you feel that's an issue at all? That was what Representative Rieger and I were discussing earlier.
The language of the original bill I liked very much, from a lawyer's point of view and having to defend an equal protection challenge under
doesn't
the state
constitution. Doesn't mention state residents, does it?
Well, I mean, it just says to residents, but it doesn't mention It doesn't indicate whether it's got to be all residents or just a subset of residents.
Yeah, and it doesn't indicate that it's a resident preference. It just says that they can grant preferences to residents.
Right, well, that's a resident preference, I think. Well, but it's not an employment preference. Okay, that's the concern that I had with the other language, was that it singled out employment preferences.
Well, let's go back to the subset then. What do you think about that?
I think this permits application of the less stringent standard to resident preferences provided to subsets of Alaska residents.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Rieger.
I guess I'm still not sure I understand what you're saying. The decision, you know, this opinion in the court case and all shows that you can apply a stricter standard of equal protection than the U.S. Constitution, or at least he's arguing that maybe you can apply a stricter standard. Now, I guess the concern that I'm expressing here is it possible that the state constitution can apply a looser standard and still prevail than the equal protection that's offered in the U.S. Constitution?
Not with respect to an equal, let's call it an equal protection analysis. The U.S. Supreme Court and various state courts have acknowledged that the minimum that has to be complied with is whatever the U.S. Constitution requires, but that individual states can establish more stringent requirements for their own states, for the application and analysis of their own state laws.
Okay, so on this issue about employment preferences within subsets of the state, you could not go beyond the equal protection provisions of the U.S. Constitution, and that would tend to limit it from being more divisive within subsets of the state than what the U.S. Constitution provides, is it?
I'm not sure I understood your question. Sorry.
Well, I don't know what the limits of the U.S. Constitution are, but I mean, if you could say...
Let me just say this. With respect to equal protection, the U.S. Constitution is pretty liberal, might not be the right word, but it usually a U.S. constitutional equal protection analysis will usually result in the law being challenged being upheld. Okay? Basically say if it makes sense to the legislature, it's okay with us. That's sort of a shorthand, but that's one way to describe the equal protection analysis under the federal constitution. Now, under the state constitution, our courts have not been quite so deferential to legislative judgment. They have applied what they refer to as a sliding scale. In the U.S. Constitution, we're getting into a constitutional law class here. Under the U.S. Constitution, the U.S. Supreme Court really says there are only two ways to look at a law that's being challenged under equal protection. Either you look at it and say and give great deference to what the legislature has done, which is a minimal, really a minimal level of scrutiny, or you apply strict scrutiny. It's either limited scrutiny or strict scrutiny. When you apply strict scrutiny, it only applies in a very limited number of areas, for instance, in the area of discrimination on the basis of race. That's probably the best single example to give you. That the court has said there are certain specific areas where they will look very closely with strict scrutiny to whether a law is justified or not. But beyond those areas, it will give great deference to what a legislature does in enacting its own laws. Now, our Supreme Court has adopted, so under the U.S. Constitution, you got this standard or you got this standard with nothing in between, except in a very limited area that isn't worth talking about here. Under the state Supreme Court's approach to dealing with equal protection under the state constitution, the court says, here's one end of our analysis and here's the other end, and we're going to decide in any individual case just how strictly we're going to analyze it and decide whether it's okay or not. So it's called a sliding scale test. They will decide for themselves how important the rights involved are, how closely the legislature has been able to accomplish whatever its goal, whether the goal is okay that the legislature wanted to accomplish, and how closely the legislature has actually come in accomplishing that goal. So very frequently, they won't apply this lowest level of scrutiny. They will apply something in between, not necessarily the highest level, but something in between, and that's what we're worried about, is this in-between area being applied where, if we were just dealing with the U.S. Constitution, we'd clearly win.
Yes. Representative Donahue.
I'd just like to ask Mr. Lawrenson a question. Mr. Lawrenson, as far as your concern regarding the specificity of an employment preference, if we deleted the word employment in this in the judiciary version, would that address your concern?
That definitely addresses that concern that I raised, yes.
Representative Rieger, continue, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, I guess the more that I hear the testimony, the more concerned I become. I originally looked at this bill as one which would apply an Alaska preference to Alaska residents, and I would strongly in favor of having that continue. But the more I hear what you're saying, this opens up a real wide open window to apply all kinds of little preferences around the state for all kinds of things. And you know, the more you testify how this might be construed by the courts, the more nervous I become. And I'm starting to think that maybe there should be some rewording which makes sure that these preferences are things which are consistent with other areas of our Constitution that say that laws should apply generally.
Well, the Constitution applies, whether it's the federal or the state, it always applies. I mean, there's nothing that you need to do here that would to incorporate the application of other applicable constitutional provisions. In other words, the Privileges and Immunities Clause is still going to apply. Commerce Clause is still going to apply.
Even if it says this Constitution does not prohibit, it seems pretty clear to me. You're
right.
Saying
well,
it does not prohibit.
We still can't abrogate the U.S. Constitution. And it's
I'm not talking about the U.S. You're saying that the U.S. Constitution is very broadly construed. I mean, they really don't care what goes on within the state,
Maybe now I see what you're focusing on. Because there's no reference here, as there was in the original bill, to preferences consistent with the Constitution of the United States. Is that really?
Well,
that language is absent in the committee substitute.
No, that's not quite. I thought that I heard you when you're describing how the U.S. Constitution is construed as them not being too concerned about what happens within individual state boundaries as far as how they apply preferences amongst themselves. And I am concerned about applying preferences amongst ourselves. And I would like to see preferences which allow us to apply a preference for Alaskans vis-a-vis the other 49 states, but not Alaskans versus Alaskans. That's my concern.
Well, I'm not quite... that's a policy concern that obviously I'm not really in a position to address. The difficulty with... I mean, if what you are concerned with is the kind of local hire law that we have right now, which has the effect of granting a preference to residents of certain economically distressed areas over other residents of the state. I guess my response to that is that may be the only kind of resident preference law that will ever be legal at all, that will ever be constitutional under the Federal Privileges and Immunities Clause.
Are you saying take that law and let's make it more restrictive? I don't know how you would do it, but... are you saying that if anything more than what was said in that were said in that bill, that it would have been struck? It would be struck down. You're quite convinced it would be struck down in the under the federal constitution, the federal courts.
Well, I don't want to.
You think?
Yeah, I think so. If it granted an across-the-board preference to all Alaska residents, whether or not they were unemployed or underemployed. If they had a job, if it provided a preference to an Alaska resident who was already employed, had a good job, had a home, was not economically distressed, I don't think there'd be any question the court would strike it down. Because in the court's view, and I think this would be under the Privileges and Immunities Clause, we wouldn't even need to get to the equal protection. In the court's view, the legislature would not have been sufficiently tailoring the preference it was providing to deal with a problem that it perceived, a social or economic problem. And there's no need, from the court's point of view, to provide an employment preference to somebody who's already got a good job. That's the way the court would approach it.
Even the federal court? Because I thought...
The federal court. That's what the federal courts have been saying. And when our state court struck down the state's local hire law, that's what it said, but it used the Privileges and Immunities Clause, in other words, the federal cases, to do that.
So in your opinion, the law, as far as employment preference, the law we have in the books is as far as you could go... under this proposed amendment.
Whether this
pretty
amendment is here or not, I think it's as far as we can go.
Because of the federal
protection. Right.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any further questions?
Yeah.
Just Representative Frank.
Thank you. Just following up on this, if we leave this Section 23 as a separate section, then is it clear then that, and especially if we took out the employment preferences, we could wind up with preferences that might be made based upon geographics or some other way of, you know, pitting residents against each other and that sort of thing?
That's certainly possible, but it won't be because of this provision.
But it would
be... We've done that now with the local hire.
I understand we've done it with the local hire law, you know, and I guess there is a, you know, the legislature passed it and accepted discrimination in employment where, you know, under those circumstances. I guess what I would be concerned about is discrimination or, yeah, I guess discrimination with regard to any other set of any other benefit or, you know, let's talk about student loans, for example, or any other kind of thing that we may want to distinguish. Oh, let's say, for example, fishing loans, and let's say we're going to have a lower interest rate for Bristol Bay this year because they had a bad season or something. Would this provision allow that to happen?
This provision would mean that the U.S. constitutional equal protection standard would apply, and it might very well be that what you just described would be upheld under the U.S. Constitution. As you were able to articulate, because we're giving a lower interest rate to Bristol Bay fishermen because they've been particularly hard hit. And if that's in fact true, if there's a legislative record that shows that that's true, I think the U.S. courts under the U.S. Constitution would be willing to permit you to single out a group in one area of the state for a particular treatment when you've got a good independent reason for doing so.
The state constitution might allow that also.
And the state constitution might also. This is just basically what this does is say the state constitution isn't going to apply, you just apply the U.S. Constitution.
Representative Brown, before I send this in to subcommittee, two more questions to Representative Brown and Representative Davis.
Does this affect at all the state's ability to give a preference based on need? And how is it that the current constitution does not affect preferences based on need? Is there something else that authorizes
it? I wouldn't say it doesn't affect them. It just... The standards of the U.S. Constitution in the various areas that a needs-based program might be challenged would still apply. And a more stringent equal protection standard might also be applied if the basis for the discrimination, although that has a negative connotation, if the basis for the distinction between one group of people and another is financial need, it would be, I think, that under the state constitution, our Supreme Court would apply its sliding scale test, okay, rather than the either very low scrutiny or strict scrutiny test that the...
Thank you.
Representative Davis?
Thank you. So let me see if I got this right. If we did have this legislation on the books or a constitution changed, then if, as Representative Frank said, if one area of the state was economically depressed, let's say the fishing industry in one area but not the other, you could grant a lowered interest rate, for example, to that area. But
I think you could do that now with sufficient justification. That particular example, I think, would probably even meet our Supreme Court's sliding scale.
With the current rules on the books today. Okay. I guess the question, and you may have covered this in your presentation, and if you did, I apologize, but in we've had our constitutional challenge to our local hire laws, I think, twice or three times that have been thrown out by the court.
We've had two local hire laws thrown out now, and the third one is in court right now.
And have they all been thrown out on the privileges and immunity?
The first two were both thrown out on privileges and immunities, yes.
So you feel that with the passage of legislation like this, then this would put you on a more solid ground for those challenges?
Because I think we have a much better chance, again, of satisfying the federal test than we do of a independent state equal protection test where the courts really, it's up to the courts to sort of decide where they're going to come down.
Mr. Chairman, certainly you'll adhere to the wishes of the chair, but it seems like all we need to do is strike this employment and we can move this out of the committee unless there's other reasons to go to the subcommittee.
Representative Frank?
Thank you. Is the current law being challenged in federal court?
It's in state superior court.
State superior court? So the Superior Court is going to look at our Constitution as well, right?
Or possibly.
I don't know.
See, we don't know. We know we'll look at it from equal protection under the federal standard because that's got to be applied. We know that it'll look at it from privileges and immunities, which is, I think, where it's either going to pass or fail. And it might look at it from equal protection under the state law. Our state Supreme Court has not yet applied Alaska equal protection in these situations. It's just a couple of judges have talked about their own concerns about whether or not the particular law would satisfy equal protection, but they haven't been the majority judges at that point. So they've been either concurring opinions or, well, I guess they're in both situations concurring opinions. There was an earlier case that you haven't heard about today that involved, and this is why I brought up bidder's preference on state projects. There was a case initiated back in, I think, 1983 by a disgruntled bidder who did not get the award simply because of the application of the 5% bidder's preference. For some reason or other, and they challenged the award, but they didn't challenge the constitutionality of the bidder's preference. They challenged whether or not the person who got the award was entitled to be treated as a resident because it was a joint venture. Part of the outfit was an outside firm associated with an inside company, and the state treated that company, that bidder, as a resident and therefore gave that resident a 5% preference, which ended up causing that company to get the award. The number one bidder in terms of lowest bid, but turned out to be second after the 5% bid preference was applied, challenged the determination that this other company was treated as a resident. They didn't challenge whether or not the law was constitutional or not. Went up to the state Supreme Court, and the state Supreme Court said the state made the right decision in treating this bidder as a resident under the laws, the way they're written, even though they're a little ambiguous, and you can argue both ways. The state properly treated this bidder as a resident, and therefore it properly applied the 5% bonus or discount, and therefore it properly awarded to the right party. Challenger, you're out. Two judges, however, wrote a separate opinion saying that we recognize this hasn't been challenged under the Constitution. We think that if it had been, we would have struck it down. It hasn't been raised, but we're sufficiently concerned about it that we're going to say we think it's unconstitutional, even though it hasn't been challenged. And they said they thought it was unconstitutional under the state equal protection law. So we have yet to have a case that challenges the bidder preference law, but we know that two justices right now think it's unconstitutional.
Representative Frank, any further questions?
Just have one final question, and that has to do with there's a number of other states that we know in our research that have some kind of local hire laws, and I guess Valdez and Vero now have some kind of a local hire laws that are local ordinances. And do those other states then possibly have are they in a category where their equal privileges and immunities clauses are less strict than perhaps ours, or is that the reason why they're able to have some of these local hire laws, which we haven't?
I think you'll find now, if you communicated with most of those states, that all of their laws are still on the books, they're not being enforced anymore. As the result of a couple of U.S. Supreme Court decisions, it's pretty clear that they are no longer constitutional. Now, in some states, they may still be enforcing them, just waiting for the challenge that's going to strike them down. But there are a lot more states that have them on the books where they, in fact, in some cases, courts have ruled them unconstitutional. In other states, they just no longer enforce them because of the way the cases have all been going.
Thank you. Thank you.
I'm going to send this in subcommittee consisting of Representative Gull, Chairman, Representative Swackhammer, and Representative Rieger to work on this bill. I'd like you to work with the sponsor, Representative Donnelly and Mr. Lawrence, and hopefully you have a product for me next week if possible. Thank you, gentlemen, on this. The next bill I'll take up is committee substitute for Senate Bill number 226, an act relating to the practice of optometry. This bill addresses the licensing of optometrists, standards of professional conduct, and authorizes the use of certain drugs by qualified optometrists. This bill carries a zero fiscal note. Is there anybody here that would like to testify on this bill?
No.
What's the pleasure of the group?
Chairman?
Yes, Gibson.
There's no one from the department that's going to testify on this?
They're here for, if you have any questions regarding this, we have Jennifer Strickland that is available for any questions.
I'd have a couple questions.
Ms. Strickland. Strickler, rather.
I guess I don't understand all the terminology used in this piece of legislation, and perhaps you could help me with it. This issue obviously has been around the legislature for a while, there's a new section here where on section 6, which has the use of drugs, and I'm not familiar with all these drugs or just what that means exactly to have these drugs being used. But I did read some of this material, and I guess there are some states that have use therapeutic drugs and others that use diagnostic drugs, which I assume therapeutic means it's treating the using treatment for the eye. And I guess I did note that it looks like prior to this time, optometrists have not had the ability to use drugs at all. And so I guess my question would be, what does this section mean, the addition of this section? Are they now being able to use therapeutic drugs, or are they now using diagnostic drugs?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Representative Davis, this section is one that we deferred comment on in our position paper because we, too, aren't familiar with all these drug terms here and probably could be better addressed by the lobbyist or one of the optometry professions here. There are 35 states which allow optometrists to use diagnostic drugs, and it's my understanding that that's what this section would be, diagnostic drugs only. And there's 13 states that allow optometrists to use both diagnostic and therapeutic drugs.
In Alaska, it's the one of two states that do not allow them to do this. The state's position is they don't have the expertise on these particular drugs to have a position on it.
I realize that, but we are allowing individuals to use those, so I was curious, as long as we're allowing them to use them, it'd be nice to know what they're writing law here, and so it'd be nice for the department to know what kind of law we're writing here.
Would you like this to go into subcommittee until you have a chance to look at these drugs?
I don't really want to use any of these drugs, but I just thought I'd perhaps get some definitive statements from the department on this. I guess my second question would be, there's no race on this. Chairman, is there a reason why this has to be passed out today?
No, you can hold it as long as you want, sir.
I'm feeling if I ask for subcommittee, I might be visited or something like that, right?
Sure. Would you like this in subcommittee, sir?
I'll take it in subcommittee if you
okay.
want.
Okay, this bill is in subcommittee, consisting of Representative Davis, Representative Wallace, and Representative Frank. Do you have a chance to look at it?
Perhaps the department could get that answer for me. Maybe they can talk to whoever knows what this is all about.
Yes. Just a question. I was wondering if there was anyone here from Health and Social Services on this drug.
No, there isn't.
On this bill.
No, there isn't.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you. So the last bill we got is House Bill number 398. This is an act relating to the appropriation limit and the budget reserve fund and providing for an effective date. This is by myself. This particular bill amends the effective date of the appropriations limit from 1988 to 1989. The governor tried to address in the front section of the budget bill, which is section 22. According to our legal department, this would not work as you would be changing substantive law in an appropriation bill. This is not legal under Article 2, Section 13 of the Alaska State Constitution. The problem with the 1988 effective date is that the capital and the reappropriation bill was not enacted until July of 1987, and there could not be included in the base. So basically, the base figure is unrealistically low. Here to speak on the bill is Mr. Hogan, and I have discussed this in a memo form to each of the finance members and also both in caucus and both caucuses, majority and minority. And as you recall, we came into special session, passed the capital budget to the amount of $165 million, which is not in the base, and also you also have the jobs bill, which that was in the base also. So basically, the administration was working on this particular problem, and our department of law says you cannot do it in the front section of the budget, which is section 22. Mr. Hogan, would you state your name for the record, please?
Mr. Chairman, my name is Jay Hogan. I'm director of budget review. The chairman has recounted the brief legal history of this. We did feel that it could be done since it changed temporary law in an appropriation bill. However, a bill of substance is equally acceptable to us. The chairman has also correctly recounted the the events that lead us to the problem we find ourselves with, and that is we're starting off using as a base year a year in which unusual appropriation events occurred, so we don't have a base from which to build. In addition, we're starting the same process in a year when there is general concern that perhaps there should be a stronger focus on measures that might help stabilize and improve employment opportunities throughout the state. So those two things together left us with a problem that we felt would make it wise to begin the base year calculation a year later than originally had been envisioned. I believe, Mr. Chairman, that we submitted, and the members have in their file, a small one-page document that leads to the dollar value of the overage of the limit. And if you would look on the bottom, we have the text of the statute itself. This is just an aside in case it is of interest to the committee or the legislature in general. The limit is an appropriation limit. It is a limit that affects your ability and your authority to deal with fiscal matters as you, at the time, deem appropriate. Part of the problem comes from the wording of the statute itself. It's kind of hard to address this issue because we never really had a statutory spending limit that was focused on the year, the fiscal year. The problem with this one is that it relates not only to the fiscal year for the appropriation, but it is tied to the fiscal year in which the appropriation became effective. So it has two things to watch out for. It does not say, for instance, appropriations made for a fiscal year. It says appropriations made in a fiscal year. You can make the argument that if your real goal is to limit appropriations, limit the growth of appropriations, that another approach would be simply to limit that growth for fiscal years. Then it is immaterial when you make the appropriation. The way this expenditure limit or appropriation limit is written, you have to watch not only the fiscal you're appropriating for, but when the bill will become effective, when it will be enacted. And that is exactly part of the problem that we have this year. We have an 88 capital budget that didn't become effective in 87. It became effective in 88. So I think when you are considering this, you may want to consider that language and the complexity of that language. It may be not exactly what you think the state should have as an expenditure or spending limit over the course of years. It's not basically inconceivable that 2 years from now we could find ourselves the same problem when a special session comes in and a portion of the budget is passed in the special session and then automatically becomes counted against the appropriations that can be made in the subsequent year.
I don't think the chair is ready to rewrite another spending limit. This particular bill is just basically the effective date. If the administration does want a bill, why don't you submit one, and we will debate the spending limit in that particular bill.
Mr. Chairman, I was just calling that to the attention as a piece of information. It's part of the reason we are in the box we're in. I don't think probably anyone wants to delve too deeply into a spending limit this year.
Representative Frank.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Jay, is there any real practical effect of having a spending limit on the books, on the statutes, and over-appropriating or appropriating in excess of that from a legal standpoint?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Frank, I suppose the answer to that is no. I can envision a situation where this might not have been addressed as it has here with two different versions, and the legislature could still leave town at the end of the session with appropriations made in excess of a spending limit. I suppose then the next step would be, is there a citizen or a group of citizens concerned enough about it to take the issue to court? I have no idea what a court would decide on that, because I suppose you would then get into the question of, well, is it of enough substance that the legislature could not exercise its judgment and pass, as it is presumed able to do, pass appropriations that it thinks are appropriate for all of the state programs or all that lead to the problem?
Could I follow up on that?
Yes, continue.
Is there, again, I know you're not an attorney, but at least I don't think you are. But,
no.
I don't know if we pass a law, if we have a law that goes against an appropriate, or that is, you know, diametrically opposed to a appropriation or something like that, if it really has any effect. But also, I wanted to ask you about the effect of the appropriation on the appropriation limit on, for example, the Rail Belt Energy Fund. Should we decide to appropriate the Rail Belt Energy Fund for a specific project in its entirety, that would seem to push us over the limit, or if we got a windfall that, you know, we spent on a capital budget or something like that. I wanted you to address that. Is it your understanding that would also...
Mr. Chairman, Representative Frank, yes, the way this is written, it is, there are certain exclusions in the beginning of the subparagraph B. There are appropriations can be made to the permanent fund or for debt service, and these are excluded. But assuming you were appropriating out of Rail Belt Energy for a major project or a group of major projects, those would be appropriations from the Treasury and would be subject to this limit, or would conversely go over the limit if you had achieved the limit through a series of other appropriations.
Thank you. Let me just follow up on that. There may be some citizen groups that would be very interested in challenging a specific appropriation, especially our energy-related project, it seems to me, if the legislature failed to remove this. Clear up the discrepancies.
Representative Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Hogan, I guess my question would be, how does this budget reserve fund or this legislation that we've passed coincide with the constitutional amendment, which we're so far behind below that one anyway, it doesn't make any sense, right?
Mr. Chairman.
This legislation was an attempt to deal with sort of the reality of where we are in the budget cycle. But it seems to me, and I'll just talk for a minute here and then you can certainly answer or comment if you like, it seems to me that this legislation, which is not a constitutional amendment, points out the fact that we can change the base year anytime we want, or if we have to come into special session, or we decide to appropriate the Rail Belt Energy Fund, or whatever we decide to do, just change the law. There's no problem. And I don't see any. I can understand what you're saying, but I don't see any big conflict here. We just and I think that's what the governor did there. Obviously, he didn't do it right, or it wasn't done right, and that's one reason why we're coming back, because it was, according to our chairman's memo, which I don't know if you saw or not, but basically it said that when he did rewrite this law, he made changes in an appropriation bill, which he couldn't do. But absent that, if he would have made two pieces of legislation which would have changed this law, then we wouldn't have this problem.
Actually, Mr. Chairman, Representatives, the Chairman was referring to, in the General Appropriations Act introduced this year, the one in January, we proposed in there Section 22, the language that would make clear the base year. The Department of Law felt that since the provisions telling when this begins are in non-permanent law, i.e. they're not in the statutes per se, that it was, and it has the effect of being an effective date, our Department of Law attorney felt that we could suggest the change, recommend the change be done in the General Appropriations Act as we did. I presume the reviser of statutes on the legislative side or someone else was of the opinion that that was not strong enough and so recommended to the chairman that a bill be introduced to do this rather than rely on the inclusion of a paragraph in the General Appropriations Act. So that's basically where we are on that situation today. Your earlier question, the constitutional spending limit, when it was last formally calculated for the presentation of the 87 budget, was at $4.5 billion.
So that spending limit has no effect whatsoever on the operation of state government.
It's heading at a far higher level than we assume we will be able to reach.
Right. And then, and sort of to the answer to Representative Franks, the effect of any spending limit really is negligible at this point. We can just rewrite the law as we go.
Well, the problem with that is we came into special session and we passed $165 million, which was the capital and reappropriation, and that falls outside of this year's spending limit, and so one of the things we're trying to do is correct that because you're going to have the jobs bill and perhaps a later capital bill that will fall outside of that.
I understand, Mr. Chairman, and I certainly support this piece of legislation, but I guess the point I was trying to drive at, and maybe it's somewhat oblique, is that if we got we received some kind of a windfall from the oil industry of $500 million and we decided to spend it all in 1 year, all we have to do is rewrite the law in order to do that. Is that correct, Mr.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman, yes.
Thank you.
Representative Porcello and Meeker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I tend to agree with you that a lot of this is building a whipping post for ourselves, I guess, and we end up doing what we think best anyway year to year, so we're really just putting something together to hang ourselves or to have the public or have the minority or have whoever beat us up on. I've tried to reconstruct these figures, switching over, instead of 165, it's probably 100 million capital or more or less that we passed last July. I tried to reconstruct by switching that back into last fiscal year and then rerunning those numbers. And I'm still having a hard time rectifying them. I'm wondering if you've done that exercise where, because obviously then you'd have to take 5% of a larger number. And I wonder if you could maybe run back. If you switched over $92 million or $98 million or whatever that figure is you're using for the appropriation last July, switched that back into the base, removed it from the 88, reduced the 150 jobs bill to 75, recalculated your 5% plus population and inflation on your larger base, what's the overage at that point? Do you have any idea?
Mr. Chairman, we calculated this internal to our own office in late November or early December, and we were using what we felt was a rule of reason. We basically interpreted the law as though it had been written for a fiscal year, and we came out with no problem. We assigned the jobs bill, for example, was assigned to the current fiscal year, because it was the governor's wish and the legislative leadership wish that it pass early and it would be an 88 appropriation. In doing that, we simply did not have a problem. That's why I went briefly through the discussion that if one were to change the language so that the appropriations were for the fiscal year and did not have a relation to the year in which they were actually made, then a large part of the problem that we have goes away. To follow up the other two items that are missing. Not only is the capital budget missing, but last year on our motion, we took approximately $48 million out of the budget for personal service items. We have requested those back in. There's nothing in the base for that. We also, there is insufficient money, it's not nothing. The other area.
I don't quite understand that. Isn't the $40 million part of the 88 fiscal year 88 appropriation?
Mr. Chairman, that was not all you recall a language on that, there's no specific dollar appropriation. So that poses the whole question, is it really there? Also, it is an appropriation that doesn't take effect until April 1st, 1988. So...
But it's all part of the same fiscal year.
It should be, yes. But again, there are ambiguities in that law if you take a rigorous interpretation of that. But again, the high value that we have been able to assign to that paragraph is about $37 million. So the portion of that roughly $50 million problem not covered by that is clearly outside and not available to build on. The other item that was not addressed was the addressing of a jobs bill. There was no base to build in an increased level of appropriation. We basically had the 88 capital budget as passed in the special session, and nothing in the year before from which to build a base. We had no capital appropriation passed with the 87 regular session. So the 87 fiscal year expired. The $100 million in general fund capital came in the 88 year and really is our 88
budget. Let me make more clear what I'm trying to reconstruct. I know that you can't do that, but another approach to this whole legislation, instead of moving the year, I mean, there's lots of different approaches, but one approach might be taking those particular appropriations in July 1st or 2nd of last year and moving those appropriations into the base year of 87. I mean, I'm sorry, in fiscal year 88. But something tells me that's not quite everything.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Porter, that is basically what we did. That is how we treated them in our calculation. But the problem comes from the last sentence on this page. For purposes of applying the limit, an appropriation is considered to be made in the fiscal year in which it is enacted, and it is that which screws it up.
Well, not to be.
We couldn't go back and change that.
Well,
at this point,
we could change the way it's calculated. We could change the way that the limit was calculated, in just like we're proposing in House Bill 398 here.
Yes, yes, you could.
But change the effective date. That's the simplest form.
Let me just, if I can get one clarification, then I can run my own numbers because I didn't hear you give the numbers. Can you tell me, you're using a factor of, looks like 4.29 or 4.3%.
Yes.
That tells me that something has, the population must have deflated. The total between the 5% inflation was, I know, at least 1.8 or 2%. What factor were you using for population?
I don't know the precise, but the population factor was presumed by the Department of Labor to decline between the years. So you're right. We had an inflation factor adding, but the population factor actually was a negative.
Could I get those figures?
I have, yes. What I would suggest is I would like Guy Bell on our staff, who did the calculations for this, perhaps to sit down with your staff or yourself or whatever, and because we have it both ways. We have it the way we would have preferred to be able to use it, but on extended review by the Department of Law, it was not acceptable.
Mr. Chairman, one quick thing, since plagiarism is very much in the news here lately, I just saw a suggested amendment by Representative Rieger. I was doing independent thinking here. I didn't see your amendment. I apologize. That was your train of thought, too.
Brilliant minds think the same way.
Representative Rieger, then Brown.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to answer some of Representative Prichot's questions. I tried to calculate out what those numbers are, but I have to admit I excluded the $37 million for personal services adjustment because I had assumed that you had backed that back into the operating base. But excluding that for the moment, if you look at the calculation sheet, there is a number which says maximum allowed is about two-thirds of the way down, $2,113,000,000. That number, after adjusting for an inflation and population in the capital budget, which is what the difference is, brings that up to $2,215,000,000.8.